Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 210, Smorgasbord, May 2022. Everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the podcast all about home cooking, getting in the kitchen, learning new things, having fun. Hey, I know I've been away for a while. I'm sorry. I took a vacation, so I took a couple weeks off of there, and then just, other things going on, getting back in the swing of things with the podcast now, though, with a new Smorgasbord episode. I'll talk about some upcoming topics in a minute, but what a smorgasbord is, if you're new to the show, first of all, welcome. It's an episode where I tackle a few different topics, so there's not one overarching theme for this particular episode, but we'll hit on a few different segments, some different topics. Now, if you hear something in this episode you're interested in and want to learn more about, if I have links or other information, I will include those in the show notes, and to find those, open up your browser of choice and head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/210. kitchencounterpodcast.com/210. That will be the show notes for this particular episode, where if I talk about something and you want to find out more, whether I'm sharing a recipe or links to a cookbook or whatever it is, you'll find those over in those show notes. Couple other quick bits of housekeeping. If you want to reach out to me, you can send an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. You can find me on all sorts of different social media networks, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'll tell you what, if you're interested and you're a Facebook person, the thing you're going to want to do is head over and check out our private Facebook group, The Kitchen Counter Coffee Break. Easiest way to find that is over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/group. All of the other social media stuff, all my handles, you can find over in the show notes. I'll put links to everything. So if you want to find me over on Instagram or whatever, head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/210 to get the links for all of that good stuff. Speaking of links to good stuff, don't forget that the Kitchen Counter Podcast is a member of Nitty Grits Podcasts, which is a network out of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum down in New Orleans, Louisiana. Lots of other great shows on the network. You can find my show there as well if you head over to southernfood.org. Not only can you find out what the other Nitty Grits podcasts are up to, but you can find out all sorts of cool stuff that the Southern Food and Beverage Museum is up to. They're doing all sorts of events now, I think most in person, but some online. So go check it out, southernfood.org. And actually today, because this is a smorgasbord episode, you know, I like to do a short cookbook review and giveaway. I'm actually going to be doing that for Liz Williams' new cookbook, Nana's Creole Italian Table. So we'll get to that in about the middle of the show. So stay tuned for a review of that book and then how you can enter for a free copy. Hey, I think I made it through all the housekeeping stuff in record time. I haven't. There's one more thing I forgot to mention. I was on another podcast recently, and I will put links again in the show notes, but go check out Cooking and Convos with Susie Miles. I was on her podcast last week, and we talked about all sorts of cooking-related things, some podcast-related stuff in there, too. So in the meantime, since you've been waiting for me to get new episodes out, head over to these other podcasts where I make an appearance and have a listen. Again, the most recent, Cooking and Convos with Susie Miles. I'll put a link in the show notes for that. So Susie, thanks for having me. I had a lot of fun. Okay, let's do this. Let's get into the regular episode, Smorgasbord May 2022. All right, a few different things to talk about today. I'm going to talk about where I've been and just a little bit of that. I want to also talk a little bit about some ideas I have for topics for upcoming episodes, so you have an idea of kind of what is in the hopper. And, I'm always looking for interesting ideas. And a lot of you folks send me things in email or on social media, which I love. So keep doing that. It does help inspire me and give me ideas for ways to work things into upcoming episodes. But today I'm going to be talking, in addition to that stuff, I want to discuss flavored oils a little bit. I'm going to do the cookbook and giveaway for Liz Williams' new cookbook that came out last month in April, I believe, Nana's Creole Italian Table. And then because where I'm at, I've talked about grilling season and outdoor cooking. It's coming up on us. I want to talk for a few minutes about my favorite cut of beef that I like to prepare this time of year. So stay tuned for that a little bit later in the show. But first, just to recap, I went on vacation. And, you know, a few episodes ago, I did a cooking burnout episode. And I think one of the comments that somebody made, I think maybe in the Facebook group that I shared, was, you know, traveling and going to different places can help with cooking burnout. Well, it did in my case. I went with the family to St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. I've talked about the Caribbean before on the show. It's one of my favorite regions of the world. I love visiting and going there. We had been to the other two U.S. Virgin Islands, St. Thomas, St. John. We'd never been to St. Croix, so we decided to give it a shot. When we read about it and learned about it, there was a lot of talk about how it's a little less touristy. It's much more agricultural. It's probably the best of the Virgin Islands for food and farm to table and the cuisine. And of course, it has amazing beaches and wonderful culture and all that kind of stuff too. So we thought, hey, why not? We're overdue for a big vacation, and it's something we had to reschedule already. So we went for it, and it was amazing. The weather was stunning. The water was incredible. The food was fantastic. Everything about it was just great. But from a home cooking perspective, you know, just being in a different place, eating food with different cultural influences, whether that's, you know, African or Danish or Spanish or French or whatever, and eating ingredients that, you know, being from Oregon, I've obviously have a lot of different ingredients available to me, as do the folks in St. Croix. They have a lot of different ingredients available to them that I never see, right? So getting down there and just being able to taste things and try different things, so good for the mental health angle of home cooking anyway. For example, we went to the Saturday Farmers Market on the island, and just trying not only different produce, but trying different products that local artisans make, like hot sauces or jams and jellies and things like that, is a lot of fun. Now, unfortunately, when you get home, you can't reproduce that stuff generally because, you know, like I don't have access to soursop at home. So I'm not going to be making any soursop, you know, hot sauce, but just trying it and eating it puts your brain in a different frame of mind, right? So it's just good for home cooking creativity. Ate some great seafood, some conch fritters, for example. Again, conch isn't really anything I have available to me here, but I ate some mahi-mahi, which I can get here, albeit it's frozen. But it's one of my favorite fish. I'm going to be doing an episode, I think, on mahi-mahi in the not-too-distant future, because even frozen, it's a fish I absolutely love to cook. It's firm, it's flavorful, it makes great fish tacos or fish sandwiches, if you like that. It's just a wonderful tropical fish and relatively sustainable. So I'm going to be talking about mahi-mahi in the near future. Also, and this was somewhat inspired by my sister Julie, who went with us, I want to do an episode on Johnny cakes, which whenever I've traveled in the Caribbean or even Central America, I've had some version of Johnny cakes. They go by different names in different places. They're basically little dough discs that are fried and they puff up and they're served breakfast, lunch, and dinner on the go. You can pair them with sweet and savory items. Just so good. And I thought, you know what, I think I might do a live cooking episode and maybe we'll tackle Johnny cakes. So we'll have that coming up in the near future, I think, as well. A couple other things, Caribbean related necessarily. I want to do an episode, and I'm going to get together with a friend of the show, Hiro, who you've heard before on the show. We're going to talk about authenticity in home cooking. We both have some pretty strong opinions about that. I've had a request for doing some kitchen hygiene and episodes about knives specifically, so I'll see if I can't work something along those lines in as well. And I have a few other potential guests coming up that I've been chatting with, and you know, I don't have any firm details yet on those, but when they come along, I'll definitely let you know. But the trip was wonderful. Very glad to be home. However, there's a saying I've heard before, which is, I would gladly spend a lifetime traveling if I could have a second lifetime to spend at home. Kind of true. I kind of get what that person was getting at when they said that or coined that phrase. But I'm excited to use some of the ideas I came up with while traveling for the show here. So keep your eyes peeled for episodes coming up of the ones I just mentioned. One thing I do want to talk about today, though, that popped into my mind while I was traveling too, is flavored oils. And went to this restaurant and I had some mahi-mahi, and they served it with a flavored oil that was akin to something in the flavor profile of like a salsa verde. And I thought, oh, you know, I love flavored oils. I love dabbling with those. And I don't think I've ever talked about it on the show. So I think I want to do that for a couple of minutes here. Because a lot of folks that I talk to, home cooks, especially people who join the Facebook group, and I ask them, what do they want to learn more about? A recurring theme, and I've said this before, so forgive the broken record, a recurring theme is they want to understand flavor and how to use herbs and spices to really bring their cooking up a level. And so flavored oil, in a way, crosses over into a couple of those different lanes. And it's really easy to pull off. And I bet a lot of you, whether you make your own flavored oil or if you don't make your own flavored oil, you probably use it and without realizing maybe that you can make it fairly easily at home. So what do I mean when I say flavored oil? Well, I simply mean an oil, whether that's a vegetable oil or an olive oil or peanut oil or avocado oil or whatever, a liquid oil that we would use in cooking or garnishing, and infusing that with flavors from other ingredients. So an obvious one in Asian cuisine would be a chili oil, for example. I know a lot of folks who like to make garlic-infused, garlic-flavored oil. Those are a couple of examples. There's a great dish I make from Ming Sai. It is a curry ginger oil that you use to saute some onion and zucchini and chicken, just adds this wonderful color and flavor to the dish, where something you wouldn't really get with just regular vegetable oil, for example. So as I was thinking of flavored oils, I was coming up in my mind with all of these examples of flavored oils, and if it's something you don't do as a home cook yet, it's something you should definitely try. So what's an easy way to pull off a flavored oil? Well, the good news is it's ripe for creativity. So whatever flavorings you think might be good, you could probably infuse those into oil. And really, this is a two-ingredient or a two-plus ingredient thing that you can improvise very easily. So you're starting with an oil, of course, and then your flavoring ingredients. There might be one item like roasted garlic. It might be multiple items like a variety of herbs or spices. But the key is infusing and steeping those flavors into your oil. Now, there are ways to do this without any heat involved, but typically if I'm making a flavored oil, it follows this sort of a trajectory. And I'll put some links to some specific recipes in the show notes, but here are a couple of examples. So that ginger curry oil that I talked about for that recipe from Ming Sai, you take fresh ginger and you dice it up. And don't worry about the ratios just yet, but you take some fresh ginger, you dice it up, you heat some neutral flavored oil. I just use vegetable oil or canola oil. And I heat it up on medium heat, and then I simmer the ginger pieces in that oil for about 6 or 7 minutes. And, you know, you're not deep frying the ginger. It's not that hot, but you're getting a few bubbles here and there. And the goal is not to darken the ginger even per se, but just cook it and steep it so that ginger flavor starts infusing into the oil. After a couple of minutes of that, or I should 6 or 7 minutes of that, I take the oil off the heat and let it cool. In another pan, I take yellow curry powder and I toast that over medium heat until the spices start to get fragrant. And then I take the ginger-infused oil that's been cooling down, I pour that into the pan with the toasted curry powder, and then I remove every, you know, stir it really well so it all combines, and then I remove it from the heat. And as soon as it cools to room temperature, I pour it into a jar, and then I've got some ginger curry oil that I can use for the recipe I'm making that night. There's a similar method you could use for garlic and using whole garlic cloves, where you take your garlic cloves, smash them a little bit to break them up just a bit. You're not mincing them or cutting them down. You're just sort of breaking them open and simmering them in some oil for, you know, 7 or 8 minutes over medium heat or so, and then removing from the heat and then straining the oil so you get the garlic cloves out of there. And then you've got a garlic infused oil that you can use to garnish bread or salads or cook with. And, you know, you can throw that in the fridge and you have garlic oil for a week. Another great recipe I've used before, it's just a beautiful oil, is you take, again, some neutral oil and you take a bunch of fresh basil. You throw the oil and the basil into a blender and puree it until the basil is just broken down and incorporated into the oil. And then you pour into a saucepan, again, in heat for 5 or 6 minutes over medium heat. And then strain it and cool it. And then you've got this beautiful basil-infused oil with a beautiful green color. Again, absolutely fantastic for garnishing or dipping bread in, or again, even cooking with. Or imagine drizzling a little bit over that, like over some caprese. It would be fantastic. So really, the sky is the limit when it comes to infusing oil with whatever flavors you can think of. I saw a recipe, I haven't tried it myself, for vanilla-infused oil, where you steep a vanilla bean that you slice open, put it in the oil, you steep it, and then you've got this beautiful vanilla-infused oil that you can use for your recipes. So think about flavored oils the next time you want to incorporate some flavors in different ways, you know, rather than just, incorporating herbs into your dish. Infuse some oil with some herbs and it will permeate your dish if you saute your vegetables or your meat with it, for example, or whether you drizzle it over as a finishing sauce, finishing drizzle of oil. You can bring different flavors and colors and just interest to your dishes in different ways. Now, there is one thing I do want to mention about flavored oils, and that's a matter of food safety. I mentioned before, don't worry so much about the ratios yet. And I said that because when I make flavored oils, I tend to make them in very small batches, or batches of that I would probably use up in a week or so by putting it in the fridge, which means to me, if I start with a cup of oil, that's about the right amount. I might not use it all in a week, but that's a good amount to work with in a small saucepan. And then, so if I were going to make garlic oil, for example, I might take 3 or 4 cloves of garlic for a cup of oil, or, a small bunch of basil for that. Or in the case of the curry ginger oil, it might be just a thumb-sized piece of ginger cut up and maybe a tablespoon of curry powder. Fluctuating in your measurements a little bit one way or the other is not going to make a huge drastic difference in your oil, but you do want enough herbs or whatever to make a difference. But the food safety, the reason I say make a small batch that you can use in a week, if you store it in the fridge, a week to 10 days is about as long as you want to go with oil. Now with flavored oil, you can freeze it, like, put your basil oil in ice cube trays and freeze them. And then you'll have beautiful little blocks of frozen basil oil that you can throw into a pan whenever you want. The food safety issue here for me is really botulism related. And I know we talked a little bit about that in the olive episode, but believe it or not, fresh garlic, fresh herbs especially, not so much a problem with dried spices, but with the fresh stuff, if you're infusing that into oil, one, you should strain it out before you store the oil. So if you make garlic infused oil or herbs, strain all of that out through a fine mesh sieve or coffee filter into whatever storage vessel you're going to use, a little jar perhaps. because any of the matter that's left in that oil, it sounds counterintuitive, but that oil is not a preserving agent. So garlic, for example, that's been, you know, roasted a little bit or even raw and thrown into oil, that is not a safe food preservation method. So that garlic could have botulism spores on it. Most living, you know, fresh produce, you run this risk. Same with herbs. So there could be botulism spores. You put them in the oil, which is a beautiful anaerobic environment, no oxygen. That is the perfect environment for a botulism spore to produce the botulism toxin. And once that happens, extremely dangerous, okay? Putting it in the fridge for a week will inhibit the growth or the development of the botulism toxin, but any longer than that, you're playing with fire. Now, I've seen people say they make garlic oil, for example, and they just leave it on their counter for weeks and weeks and months or whatever, you know, refilling it as they need to. I would not do that. That seems risky to me. And contrary to popular belief, cooking your garlic, for example, roasting it before you put it in the oil, that does not kill botulism spores. So even cooking your food will not neutralize the botulism risk. So if you're making infused oils, and I'm not trying to scare you away from trying it, just be aware that they have a very short shelf life and you want to use them up. I like to use them up within about a week before I either use it all or get rid of it. Now, not to go down too much of a tangent, but you're probably wondering, Roger, then why can I go to the store and buy flavored oils and they seem to have a really long shelf life? Well, like with most things you buy in the store, there's other ingredients they can add which will inhibit the development of botulism or other microbes. They may have also acidified their fresh ingredients. And I'm actually going to put a link to this in the show notes, but the University of Idaho Extension Department put out a paper on how you can at home, using the correct ratios and ingredients and certain acids, could acidify your garlic and herbs so they last longer in your oil. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But again, just be aware that putting fresh ingredients, even if you cook them a little bit, into oil is not a food safe preservation method and should be consumed fairly quickly. All right, I'll put links to some great flavored oil recipes in the show notes. Check it out. All right, so this is a smorgasbord episode, and you know that I like to do cookbook reviews and giveaways during these smorgasbord episodes. And today I have a very special one I want to talk about by my friend Liz Williams down at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, part of the Nitty Grits Network. She has written a fantastic cookbook slash history memoir called Nana's Creole Italian Table, Recipes and Stories from Sicilian New Orleans. You know, the more cookbooks I get a hold of and look at and read, review, whatever, I am coming to find that my favorite type of cookbooks are the books that are part cookbook, part recipes, part memoir, history, cultural understandings of some sort. I get so much more out of books like this, even if I don't end up cooking a lot of the recipes, which, let's face it, if you have a lot of cookbooks, or even if you only have a few cookbooks, you probably only end up cooking a few recipes ever out of these things. But oftentimes for me, what's even more valuable are the stories and the understanding that come along with the recipes. And this book is no different. Liz takes a personal approach with this because she is descended from Sicilians who came to the United States, specifically the New Orleans area, about 100 years ago. So throughout this book, she makes many references to her grandmother, grandfather, her parents, other family members, and people not in her family, but in the local community that impacted the way her family and the other Sicilian Americans, the other Italian Americans that came to New Orleans, impacted the way they not only cooked and ate their food, but interacted as, as immigrants to the United States, eventually, as she puts it, becoming indistinguishable from all other Americans and all other New Orleanians. The book is divided into chapters, which are part history lesson and memoir and part food category. So, for example, Coming to New Orleans is chapter one, and it deals with condiments and snacks. So you get some background on her family's history coming to New Orleans, but then you have plenty of stories and recipes in the condiments and snacks category. Finding a place in their new land is the next chapter, and it covers vegetables and fruit, prejudice and pasta, which of course covers pasta and starches, and so on and so forth. The book itself clocks in at about 180 pages. It is chock full of really, really good family recipes. And what I love about the book also, like when I think of New Orleans or Southern Louisiana, I think of Cajuns. I think of the African influences. I think of the Spanish and French and ultimately the American influences and things like that. I don't think a lot about Italian or Sicilian influences, so it's certainly a group that I overlook as you being an outsider from New Orleans. I don't live there. I'm not really intimately familiar with the history of the city or the region, so this does shed a light in a dark corner that I had on a group of people that really made their mark in the city and the culture, and I love the mix of both of recipes that have their feet planted firmly in both types of cuisine. So in this book, you'll find solid Creole recipes for the standards like jambalaya, red beans and rice, and tons more. And then you find Sicilian staples like arancini, which are rice balls, or pasta alla norma, which is a pasta with sauteed eggplant, tomatoes. But even more interesting, you find recipes and examples, I guess what you would say, are fusion between those two cuisines, or even those two cuisines and more. You know, things like Creole Sicilian shakshuka or Sicilian barbecue shrimp. So there's a really, really nice variety of recipes. So even if you're only after a good solid cookbook for Sicilian Italian recipes, this will fit the bill. But there's so much more with the Creole, Italian, and the New Orleanian influence. So Liz, your book, Nana's Creole Italian Table, I'm absolutely loving going through this. I've already got several things planned out that I'm going to cook from this. So thanks for writing this and opening up my eyes to the interesting story of Sicilian immigrants in New Orleans. Now, you might be wondering, how can I get a hold of this book? And if you are and you're impatient, I will definitely put a link to Amazon where you can pick up a copy of the book. Of course, you could always go to your local independent bookseller, which I recommend anyway, and seeing if they carry the book, or if not, if they can order it in for you. But if you're feeling lucky, you could certainly enter my giveaway to win a free copy of Nana's Creole Italian Table. How do you do that, you ask? Well, it's very simple. Head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/giveaway. That will take you to the giveaway page for this cookbook. Follow the instructions there, and you'll be entered to win a copy. And what you're going to need to do to enter, at least you're going to have to provide your email address and enter that way. I don't use your email address for any marketing or sending messages or anything like that. It's simply so I know who you are, and I can get a hold of you if your name is drawn, so I can ship the book to you. That's one way to enter, the most simple way to enter. But you could also do some of the other actions like follow me on Instagram or visit the Facebook page, things like that. It'll all be on the page at kitchencounterpodcast.com/giveaway. So you have to do that before the end of the month because the contest closes at the end of the day on May 31st. So if you try to enter after May 31st, 2022, the giveaway will already be over and you'll be out of luck. So definitely don't delay. Head over to the webpage, enter before May 31st. After May 31st, I will randomly draw one name from the list of entrants. And if you're the lucky winner, I'll get a hold of you and ask you how you'd like to have me ship your book to you. And we'll get it in the post. And you'll be cooking some amazing Creole Italian dishes before you know it.
Thanks for listening. This is Liz Williams from Tip of the Tongue on the Nitty Grits Podcast Network. Learn more at southernfood.org.
Well, spring has pretty much sprung here in the Pacific Northwest. Although it's been quite a rainy, wet spring so far, I think we broke records in April for rainfall. I would not be surprised if we didn't break records in May when it's all said and done for rainfall. Now, I am an Oregonian since birth, and I grew up near the Oregon coast, so rain and wet weather, I am no stranger to that. It feels like home. But darn it, I really, really would like it to dry out a little bit because I want to get outside and I want to barbecue and smoke and grill and do all these things. And yeah, I can do it in the rain. And if I am such a true Oregonian, I shouldn't complain about that at all. But dang it, I want to be dry when I do it. So I've had a few opportunities, of course, already. And I know some of you are in the same boat, or maybe even if you live in the land of eternal sunshine, you just like to get out and cook. But maybe you're wondering what you should get on the grill or the smoker. So today I thought I would share my absolute favorite cut of beef these days for getting outside and cooking. And pro tip, it's actually really, really great for cooking indoors too. So anything I'm going to tell you right now, you can easily translate to indoor cooking if you don't have access to a grill or a smoker or anything like that. But you know, when you think of beef and you think of barbecue, or maybe if you think of grilling, you probably think of hamburgers, you probably think of steaks, things like that, maybe kebabs. When you think of low and slow barbecue smoking, I usually immediately think of brisket. These are all great types of beef for getting outside and cooking. And brisket is pretty unbeatable, except it takes so much work. And look, nothing better than a real low and slow, juicy, tender brisket. But sometimes you don't have 12 or 20 hours to prep it, smoke it, make it, whatever. So what do you do if you want really good beefy flavor, but you don't want to spend multiple hours getting there? Well, enter the tri-tip roast. Now, I don't know how widespread tri-tip roasts are, or at least it's a fabricated cut, so that's what it's called where I'm from. Sometimes they call it a bottom sirloin roast, a Santa Maria roast, triangle roast, Newport roast. There's lots of names for it. So where you're from, it might be something a little bit different. But this is the cut that comes from the bottom sirloin, towards the back of the animal. Unlike the brisket, which is very sinewy and takes a lot of long and low, slow cooking to really make tender, the tri-tip roast, which you can even cut into steaks, is more akin to something like a sirloin steak. It's got good marbling, incredible beefy flavor, and a roast weighs in at an average of like 2 pounds or so. You can have one of these cooked up within a couple of hours tops. Now, the tri-tip roast really gained popularity in the 90s on the West Coast in and near Santa Maria, California. It was a special cut that the pit masters here on the West Coast really gravitated towards and made famous locally. And as I understand it, that sort of spurred an awakening throughout the rest of the country for this particular cut of meat. Now, unlike a brisket, which I said already takes many, many hours because you have to do that long, low, and slow cooking to really give the heat the time to break down the muscle fibers and the collagen to make that brisket fall apart tender. You're really cooking your brisket. You know, you're not cooking your brisket medium or medium rare. It would be way too tough to handle. Well, what's great about a tri-tip is you can cook it to something like a medium or a medium rare. It doesn't really need that long, low, slow cooking to break down the collagen and get tender. You can treat it kind of like a big steak, which means you can actually cook a tri-tip roast, you know, in about an hour, depending on the temperature you're cooking it at. If you're cooking at 400 degrees Fahrenheit, let's say, you could probably have that 2-pound tri-tip cooked and rested within an hour and 10 minutes. If you want to go a little bit lower, I like to cook mine around 275, and it takes usually for a 2-pound tri-tip probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 90 minutes to 2 hours, and you've got a really impressive looking piece of protein that's done in a fraction of the time as the real tough cuts that need the low and slow, and it's going to be every bit as flavorful as those other cuts. Now, I know a lot of folks listening really have trouble, or really, maybe trouble is the wrong word, really want to know how to cook meat better. The tri-tip is very easy. Salt, pepper, whatever rub, seasoning rub you want is really all you need to do to it. You don't really even need to marinate it, though you could. You don't need to brine it or anything like that to get good results. But what you do really need for a tri-tip is a good meat thermometer. I like the digital instant readout type, so you'll be able to cook your tri-tip or whatever other cut of meat or poultry or whatever it is you're making to the exact temperature you want, so you don't have to worry about overcooking it. Because unlike some of the tougher cuts like chuck and brisket, you don't really want to overcook your tri-tip because it can turn dry and tough and chewy. So if you get yourself a meat thermometer, if you don't already have one, it will nearly foolproof this method for you. So my favorite method of doing tri-tip, I already mentioned, is a little bit on the lower temperature side. Heat your grill to around 275 Fahrenheit. If you don't have a grill and you're doing it in the oven, same thing. Just heat your oven to 275 Fahrenheit. Bring your tri-tip roast out to room temperature. Go ahead and season it however you'd like. I like to use a good barbecue rub. Really anything, salt and pepper would be just fine as well. And then while the oven's preheating, I'm just letting that tri-tip warm up a little bit, or at least come out of the fridge and warm up closer to room temperature. And I have the meat thermometer probe with the wire, so I can put it in and connect it to the display that sits outside of the grill or outside of the oven, so I can continually monitor the temperature of the tri-tip. So then at 275, it goes in. I don't fuss around with it at all. I do not touch it. I just watch the temperature. And then as soon as it hits about 135 or to 138, I'll go ahead and take it out, put a little aluminum foil over the top of it as it rests, and that will cook up to a good medium temperature, about 140. Of course, if you like more medium rare, you can pull it off a few degrees earlier, and you'll be fine. Now, this is why I talk in generalities when it comes to time. I don't want to say it's exactly 90 minutes or 2 hours. Your tri-tip may be different size. Your oven or your grill may be running hotter or colder. So definitely use that meat thermometer. And then the last thing to know about a tri-tip is you want to look at the way the grain runs in the meat. And the weird thing about a tri-tip is it will usually run in two different directions. So you might need to cut your tri-tip in half and then slice each portion against the grain. So you're cutting those muscle fibers into shorter pieces, which will make a more tender, melt-in-your-mouth bite. And that's it. I will put some recipes and information on tri-tip in the show notes. I'm curious, though, are you familiar with tri-tip? And if not, do you know it in your area as some other name? If you can't find it or you don't think it's in your area, chances are if you go to the meat counter at your supermarket or you find a butcher, they should be able to get it for you, no problem. But get a hold of a tri-tip if you're looking for something different in the beef category that is still quite an impressive cut of meat. Great for guests. Great if you want to cook it at the beginning of the week and have lots of leftovers for the remainder of the week. You can't really go wrong with a nice tri-tip roast. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for another episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Hey, thanks for being patient while I took a little break. I'm back. There's going to be more episodes coming soon. So I'm excited to bring some of these to you. Don't forget that the show notes for this episode are over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/210. There you will find links to recipes and other resources. And don't forget to head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/giveaway to enter to win a copy of Elizabeth Williams' Nana's Creole Italian Table, Recipes and Stories from Sicilian New Orleans. Speaking of Liz, you can find her podcast, Tip of the Tongue, as part of the Nitty Grits Network down at southernfood.org, along with yours truly, the Kitchen Counter Podcast, also a part of that great network. And look, I hope you're as excited for spring and eventually summer as I am. I hope you've got a lot of great stuff planned for your kitchen or your outdoor cooking, whatever the case may be. I'd love to hear about it. Send me a note to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. Tell me all about it. All right, everybody. Until next time, I'm Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy cooking.